You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Rachel Silber Devlin. Her new book is Snapshots of My Father, and if the name sounds somewhat familiar, it should. John Silber, her dad, was the president of Boston University for many, many years, and also a candidate, gubernatorial candidate, for governor back in the 90s here in Massachusetts. And I've asked Rachel to join us this evening. She's done a wonderful job of putting together, as she says in the book, Snapshots of My Father, episodes of growing up with John Silber, the man himself, the personal side, the professional side. So for the next half hour, we will be talking with Rachel Silber Devlin. Rachel, nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I think if I were to sit down with almost anybody, anybody that feels comfortable, I guess, with writing anyway, they would say, I would have loved to have talked about or written something about my dad, because I love my dad and the experiences we had, the good, the bad, the ups and downs. But you took it and crossed the finish line. But first and foremost, you come from a fairly large family. Were you the designated author to fill in any of the blanks or bring to the public the book, talking about your dad? Were you the one most likely to write this book?
You know, I guess I was, because I've always been a writer. I've just always been interested in writing and keeping notes and interesting conversations and things like that. I also, this sad time when my dad died, I wrote something about him that I was able to read at his memorial service, and I think my sisters were all pretty overwhelmed that it turned out to be so moving. And I think that kind of led to writing the book.
Yeah, and it's interesting because many people may not remember the political side of John Silber, but they certainly remember the educator, the administrator. But from what you remember, I mean, obviously, you know your dad better than anybody in the world. Was education, was that first and foremost in his life, his first love?
It really was. He always thought of himself as a teacher. And even as a president of a university, he thought of it as a teaching role. He felt that his confrontations, even with students, that was a teaching experience, where he always thought activism should be something that was actively doing good, not just shouting down the other side, because as a real classical liberal, he always thought it was really important to hear all sides, to have an actual discussion, and maybe you could then come to some understanding of what is the truth in the situation. You can't do that if you're just being shouted down.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it makes sense. I mean, you want to at least hear two sides before anybody can draw any conclusion or come to a final decision. Obviously, the two sides need to meet first and foremost, get off their chest what they want to. And it sounds like your dad, as you said, being a liberal, nonetheless, he was willing to lend an ear, if you will, to hear the other side and then go from there. But here's the other part that I've got to ask you. I mean, you raised and born in Texas, that's it's still the USA, but it's a long way from New England. How did this all take place, where he goes from Texas and brings the large family up to Massachusetts, end up being the president of Boston University? Was that something that he actively sought out, or did they come looking for him?
My dad got fired from the University of Texas. He had a confrontation with the Board of Trustees and so forth, especially the head of the Board of Trustees, Frank Irwin, who wanted to keep enlarging the university to the point where it didn't have as much of a cohesive community. And also, he wanted to divide the College of Arts and Sciences into the College of Sciences and the College of Liberal Arts, so that my dad always thought students should have a well-rounded education, and people who are just in the liberal arts should know something about science and mathematics and so forth. People who were in the sciences should know something about the liberal arts. He thought that was a really important thing for education. So then Frank Irwin finally called my dad into his office and said, John, I'm going to make you famous. I'm going to fire you. And he did. But it was also because my dad was becoming political. He was making speeches, and it wasn't just his liberal speeches on the college campus. It was going to places where people had money, like even country clubs, and making speeches. And it didn't take too much for Frank Irwin to see that Pop was going to supplant some of his candidates for some of these offices, and that certainly might have been the case.
Yeah, it almost sounds like there was a little bit of a vindictiveness on the part of the president, and or jealousy. Who's this guy who's undermine the college and put forth his own ideas? But that's what. Again, Rachel, this is what set him apart from other people, especially in the education world. I mean, that he not only was he had a passion, as you said, for teaching and enlightening young people, but he also had a side to him where he had to put forth his ideas and the things that he felt very passionate about, whether people accepted it or not. Does that kind of sum up what he was like?
Absolutely. You couldn't stop him. I remember early on I was at a PTA meeting because I was going to dance and sing. I was in second grade or something. And the head of the PTA was talking about how teachers were so self-sacrificing and so forth. And Pop was just sitting there, and he finally got up and said, he made a speech about higher salaries for teachers. And the whole place went wild and clapped and everything. And I realized, this is who he is.
And that was fine, right? I mean,
it was wonderful. I was proud of him.
Yeah.
Very proud. Yeah. Well, this started early for him. He remembers when he was 10 years old on a bus, and an elderly black woman got on the bus, and Pop stood up and offered her his seat, and then some other people yelled at him, and the woman just went back to the back of the bus. But my dad was so angry, just at 10 years old, that everything he'd been taught by his parents and in Sunday school, that you're deferential to women and to the elderly, that it was being flouted that day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He refused to sit down. He stood for the rest of the ride.
Well, the interesting thing is, and I'm sure it must have been frustrating for him, I mean, to this day, Texas is a fairly conservative state, continues to be. And I would imagine that anybody with more liberal leanings probably found it very frustrating. So might that have been another part of the impetus to, as you said, once he got fired, to move on, and perhaps New England had an environment that he found more friendly?
I don't know that that's the case, because I think he would have loved to stay in Texas and do and continue his work there. Mm-hmm. But because he was fired, he started getting offers from all across the country. I mean, at dinner time, we would talk about California or Colorado or, the different places where he was being looked at, and he would go visit these places and talk to them. But finally, he was offered the University, Boston University, and it was such an attractive offer, partly because of the history in Boston and the New England area that is such a rich cultural environment. And then also because Boston University was on the brink of bankruptcy. You might not think, oh, why is that attractive? But it was also, they were willing to offer him free rein practically to do his thing, to bring in top teachers, to transform the university culturally and educationally, to make it really competitive nationally, and that was just such an attractive offer.
I think most people would agree with that. Today, yeah, it stands out nationally, and I'm sure John Silber's footprint, if you will, thumbprint is yeah, on that. I've visited that campus, and it's downtown. But there are more school. In other words, you can create your future if you're willing to put your nose to the grindstone. I mean, it has really, has really come a long way in the last 30, 40 years, as I said, internationally and nationally. I just want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Voney, your host. My guest this week is author and educator Rachel Silber Devlin. And as I said at the outset, the middle name, Silber, yes, she is that Silber, the daughter of John Silber, the former president of Boston University and at one time gubernatorial candidate for governor here in Massachusetts. And Rachel has put between the pages of her new book, Snapshots of My Father, just what we're talking about, a real glimpse into the life of John Silber, both on a personal level and in his professional capacity. And Rachel, it's not unusual that people especially higher education, we know that from the 60s, especially when you get out to, as you talked, you mentioned California, there were a lot of people in higher education, especially opposed to the Vietnam War and other issues, civil rights certainly was one of them. So your dad was no stranger to that, but nonetheless, some people would say, well, you got a coveted position here, John. You got a good salary, you got security, you got free rein. Don't rock the boat. But I get the sense that he could easily be frustrated, as you said, by things that he didn't think were just, things that he felt weren't right. And at the very least, at least put forth his ideas or his opinions and hope that it would resonate. And it did, right? And many people listened and listened intuitively to what he had to say, right?
Yes, they did. But he also had a lot of opposition. He, especially on college campuses, Pop was way ahead in realizing that one of the most important issues is freedom of speech. And when he didn't allow people to just shout down the other side, when he didn't allow them to, by protesting, stop events from happening, he was called a fascist for doing that. What he's doing is protecting the civil rights of the people who are trying to have a speaking event or who are trying to have a discussion. And so there were lots of people who were activists at that time who considered their protests more important than the speaking engagements or conferences that were going on by other people. So they thought they had more rights than others. Mm-hmm. And putting a stop to that, it just didn't fly with a lot of professors and students at that time. And, it's a big problem today. It's one of the biggest problems in education is there's no discourse. There's no, you're not allowed to say certain things. You're not allowed to even have opinions that are not the dogma of the left. And that's a problem on college campuses.
Yeah, I think most people would certainly agree with you, and frustrating because here we are in the year 2023, and we thought we had come a long way in changing all of that. So I guess because you talk about this in the book, Snapshots of My Father, that he was widely misunderstood, and as I said earlier, most people thinking, you know, John, you got it made, just, you know, keep quiet, you know, keep your focus on putting forth Boston University. Let's get more. Let's get more students here. Let's get the name out there. But he felt, and kudos to him for that. Not comfortable just sitting back. You know, I'm doing my job, but while I've got this extra time and I've got this intellect and this energy and courage, I want to be able to, you know, talk about issues. Why should we be afraid to talk about issues? So I guess what I'm trying to say is when he would come home at night, and you know, sitting around the dinner table, maybe talking with all of you and with your mom, did he voice his frustrations about that, as you said, that, you know, they want you to play a certain role and not deviate from that role?
You know, he talked about everything. Dinner time was kind of a free-for-all at our house. Everybody had opinions, and we were always discussing issues and world issues and local issues and issues at our schools, and so that we talked about everything. But the amazing thing is, for somebody who was so busy and so dynamic, he did come home to dinner. That was the goal. Sometimes he'd be late and we would wait. And sometimes we'd be hungry, but we'd still wait. But that was, even though he knew he was going to go back to the office for several hours after dinner. So it never seemed like it was a duty to be there. It seemed like he was there was some kind of magnetic pull, and he really wanted to be there with all of us.
I kudos to him. I mean, I think that's amazing, as you said, with a schedule that he had, being pulled in so many directions, making the point to be, even if it was, as you said, sometimes late, sometimes somewhat hurried. You know, I've only got 45 minutes, but he wanted to see each one of you, reconnect after a long day. And I think that's, you know, I really think if you're going to be a parent, that's certainly a big part of being a parent. Let's move on a little bit to the political side. What was the political pull part and parcel of the frustration, as you talked about earlier, of not being, you know, being a college president does give you a platform. But as you said, board of directors and people above you may not share in everything you have to say or the things that you believe in. But was the political part of John Silber an offspring of the frustrations he felt by not being able to say and do enough as president of Boston University?
I think he was always interested in politics. I think even early on in Texas, he was interested in politics and had goals in that direction. I just don't think that he ever saw any boundary of his interest. He was interested in the local issues. He was interested in the state issues, the country's issues, world issues. He saw the whole world as of interest to his thinking.
Was the he went up against Bill Weld, who eventually won the governorship. Was there ever any bitterness on his part that, you know, that he didn't get the governorship or, you know, wasn't elected? And did he ever talk about, you know, after the fact that, you know, if he had any regret in life, it would have been that he didn't get elected and he would have loved to have at least had the opportunity, to be governor?
You know, he didn't talk like that. it was disappointing at the time, but he understood it, and he certainly never felt any bitterness toward Bill Weld, who then appointed him to be the head of the Board of Education for Massachusetts. So that was another area that he was able to influence, and it was an area that he was really interested in. But the, you know, the learning curve for running for office is very steep. It's very hard to learn everything you need to know in an election, and this was his first election.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Weld had run before.
Right.
He was way ahead of us. He knew so much more about politics. And also, my dad realized after the election that his temper had cost him the election. He was there, you know, we had that Natalie Jacobson interview that was supposed to be a friendly Sunday evening interview with the family having dinner and so forth. It didn't turn out to be that kind of an interview. It was more of a, it went on for hours, and then it was edited down, and it was quite unfriendly for a lot of it. You know, asking my son, how do you feel when they say terrible things about your grandfather? Things like that are just, we felt like it was out of line.
Yeah.
And so Pop had some choice words for her at one point. And of course that was edited and played over and over on a loop by Dick Morris, who was Bill Weld's PR guy at that time.
Right.
And but Pop understood that. He said, you know, he knew that was the reason, because the race was so close, and that interview, even though it had happened a month before, was held back and played just before the election when Pop was up in the polls.
Yeah.
So it was too bad, but Pop always had a million things going on. You know, he had the Huntington Theater that he had helped create at Boston University. He had the Opera Institute at Boston University. As young people and then on into adulthood, we went to more plays and operas and performances, musical performances of different kinds. And the arts were just maybe one of Pop's greatest loves. He was also a sculptor, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that. So the, as you said, and you described that in the book, he was a multifaceted individual with talents and interests in so many directions. And I got to think, Rachel, correct me if I'm wrong, that with that diversity, with that ability to, plug into so many different facets of life, that as much as he was disappointed with the outcome of the governor's race, it certainly didn't set him back any. He had plenty of projects to work at. And as you said, the Chancellor of Education, I think to this very day, I'd like to believe that many people across the nation and even across the globe still look at Massachusetts as being the leader or a leader still in education, especially higher education. So, he had, once again, a new challenge, but one that I'm sure he was up for and one that he relished. In serving on, we've got a few moments left, but I got to ask you at the end of the day, how much of an impression did he leave on first and foremost yourself, and then your other siblings? I mean, when it was all said and done, I know for myself, I look back and I think, oh, geez, I wish I had listened more. Or, when he or my mom or him did something, it now resonates with me. And I'm saying, I'm just so grateful that I had them for parents. And I get the sense that you feel the same way.
I do. And I do feel it about both my parents. My mother was such an intelligent and educated lady. And when she met my dad, she said that he was the first boy that she met that was as smart as a girl. And they became debate partners and then married when they were 20 years old. So they had a very long, long life together. And when I was working on the book, I just became overwhelmed by all of their accomplishments and everything that they had done. And it was, I became even more impressed with my parents.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think you just took the words out of my mouth. I think sometimes we don't stop long enough to put on, and maybe it requires the evolution, as they say, of maturity first. But you get to a point, and sometimes it's after they've passed that we put on the brakes and say, "Huh, what was wrong with me? What was I thinking? Why didn't I realize back then? Why didn't I say more? Why didn't I do more? Why didn't I show more?" And I'm not disparaging anybody. I'm just saying we all look back with some regret, saying, "Boy, I was the luckiest guy, the luckiest woman on the face of the earth, right, to have them as parents."
I do feel that way,
and it certainly comes through in the book, Snapshots of My Father. Obviously, the book is out there now. Snapshots of My Father, depicting the life of John Silber growing up among a family, eight children, right, Rachel? There were eight children.
Yes,
God.
Seven children plus the son of some very close friends who died.
Yeah. So I mean, he had his hands full not only on the personal level, but I suppose on the professional levels too. If people want to get more information about you personally, specifically, is there a way they can reach out to you? Is there a website? Is there your blogging?
Well, of course, the book is on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, but I'm on Facebook and I'm also on Instagram.
Great. Great. And again, the book is, as Rachel said, it's widely available now, Snapshots of My Father, where she goes into detail on the life and times of growing up with John Silber, the former Boston University president, and then the gubernatorial candidate who transplanted his family from Texas here to New England, and to this day has left a legacy continues to go on. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. Again, for the public eye, this is Al Vona.